I love it. Good morning. My name is Jeremiah. I'm one of the pastors here at Westridge, and we are thrilled that you're here. Thanks so much for joining us. I want to say hello to those of you in our parent viewing area. Thanks for joining us there. That's a great option if you do have small children that you prefer to keep with you during the service. And I want to say hello to those of you who are checking this out online as well. Thanks for joining us through that avenue. Also, you can follow along with your outline, or if you have the YouVersion app, the Bible app, you can go to the bottom right corner where it says More, and then click on Events and search Westridge Church, and you can find this same note sheet. If you want to follow along on your smart device, you can do that as well. Man, it's awesome to have you here with us, and it's awesome to have our high schoolers back. They were gone last week, and a huge shout out to our high schoolers who this last week, I believe we had 36 high school students and leaders who were packed into 6 minivans traveling to New York City, and my daughter was there on that trip as well. So traveled to Ohio one day and then spent the night at a church and traveled on to New York City the next, and then served there all week, and then Friday morning took off, made it back to Ohio, and then yesterday morning left from Toledo, Ohio, and came all the way home. And so got home about 8 o'clock last evening. And first of all, I think it's awesome for our high school students to be able to leave our community. And these are kids who worked to raise money so they could pay to go somewhere and serve other people. So that's pretty awesome. And in that experience, they also, I think, just build relationships with each other and get to get outside of their own sort of area of living and see how other people live and serve other people. And it's a great way to experience God's love. And then a huge shout out to our adult leaders and volunteers for driving and keeping those kids safe and spending a week sleeping on air mattresses. And man, shout out to you guys. Way to go. Really, really proud of all of our leaders and all of our students. And then, man, this last weekend, we celebrated 4th of July, which is awesome because 4th of July landed on a Wednesday this year, so we use that as an excuse for a 5-day weekend, most of us, right? And basically, as Americans, what we did then is we just ate a lot of food for 5 days. That's how we celebrate stuff in America, is with food. And you know, whenever there's a holiday, we eat food. Whenever someone gets married, we eat food. Whenever someone graduates, we eat food. Because there's something, food is pretty much synonymous in our culture with celebrations. And there have been endless amounts of TV shows and documentaries that have been produced over the past few years that all center around food. I mean, think about it. We live in the golden age of television because now there's a food network. A whole network dedicated to food. So think about the shows that have come on just in the last several years. You have Top Chef. You have Cupcake Wars, Hell's Kitchen, Chopped, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. There's a new show that's come out recently on Netflix called Nailed It. Maybe you've seen this. These are people who basically the extent of their baking prowess is that they've made a birthday cake at home. That's basically the extent of their knowledge. And then they basically show them this Pinterest-worthy kind of cake, and they have to match it with very limited experience. And at the end, then the host, they put them side by side, and the host says, "Nailed it." And just to give you a glimpse of that show, here's a small clip from that. Check this out.
Let's see what you did, Tony.
Nailed it.
I don't mean to laugh, but your princess is terrifying. She is so scary looking, and I don't think anybody's coming to rescue her. Oh, no, and then your dragon got decapitated.
Yes.
But I love this cake so much.
The princess is a little bit scary. The eyes, you know, those big eyes, she just wake up.
What voice do you think your princess has?
Hi, guys. You need to kill that dragon. Off with his head.
So her voice matches her face. If you stare in her eyes, you'll get, you
nope.
know, you could.
No, thank you. I won't do it.
Okay.
It's so great. If you stare in her eyes, nope, I'm not going to do it. It's funny how many different shows there are about food. And it's not just Americans that have appetites, and it's not just appetites for food. As human beings, we have appetites for all kinds of things. We have appetite for progress. We want to see continual progress in our lives or in our careers. We have appetites for acceptance. We want to be accepted. We want to fit in. We have an appetite for that. We have an appetite for respect. We have an appetite for recognition. We have an appetite for love. We have an appetite for stuff and for things, right? And today we're going to look at a story from a couple of brothers from about 4,000 years ago that actually teaches us some valuable lessons about our appetites. And the first thing that we need to understand about appetites is this. Number one, God gave us appetites. Appetites are God-given. God is actually the one who gave us appetites to begin with. Appetites are a very natural and normal part of our lives. Think about this. Going back to the very start of creation, God creates appetites. He creates our desire for food. He created our desire for companionship. He created our desire to achieve, our desire to succeed, our desire to accomplish things. God gave us the desire to create. God gave us the desire to build. Our ability to build and to create and the desire to do that is because of the DNA of God that's imprinted in us, that we are created in the image of a creative God, of a God who builds. And so we have a desire to create and to build and to accomplish and to achieve. And so appetites in and of themselves are not a bad thing. Appetites are a God-given thing. Without appetites, we wouldn't be able to accomplish the things that we accomplish. We wouldn't be able to create the things we create or to build the things that we're able to build with God's help. And so God gave us appetites. But number two, if appetites aren't managed, they become destructive. If appetites aren't managed, they become destructive. And we don't even need a Bible verse to tell us this. If we look at our own lives, we know that this is true. Right? We recognize this very quickly. When we reflect on our own lives, any appetite that we haven't learned to manage actually becomes very destructive. If we don't learn to manage our appetite for companionship and sex, and we pursue it at all costs, it becomes destructive. If we don't learn how to manage our appetite for respect, and we start to control people and demand things from people, it becomes destructive. If we don't manage our appetite for money and stuff, and we just push ourselves and exhaust ourselves and pursue it at all costs, it becomes destructive. So appetites need to be managed. And yet, here's a very sobering thought. Number three, appetites can be managed, but never satisfied. Appetites can be managed, but never satisfied. That's the nature of an appetite. The reason it's an appetite is because it is never fully satisfied. And it doesn't matter how much money we make, and it doesn't matter how much food we eat, and it doesn't matter how much success we achieve, there is only one word that our appetites know, and it's the word more. More, more, more. Appetites are never fully and finally satisfied. And yet, for all of us, whether we think this way or not, the reality is there is someone or something, some sort of achievement, some type of recognition, some type of status that we believe will finally make us feel like we've arrived, that we believe will bring us ultimate satisfaction. But we'll never arrive because an appetite only knows one word, more. More, more, more. Think about it like this. How many times have you backed up from the table after Thanksgiving dinner and just patted your stomach? Oh, I'm so full. I don't think I could ever eat another bite. And what are you doing 3 hours later? You are eating pie. You are making a sandwich with the leftover turkey meat, right? You're scrounging through the refrigerator. You're looking for something. Oh, I'm kind of hungry. 3 hours earlier, you were saying, I'm so stuffed, I can't eat another bite. And the same is true with stuff. The same is true with our stuff. Like, when I first bought my 1988 Chevy Celebrity, I thought that would be the last car I ever owned, man. It was amazing. It was a dream vehicle. I was 16 years old, and I had just bought this royal blue 1988 Chevy Celebrity. And that car lasted me for years. And then I realized they make cars without bench seats. Let's try one of those. And it's the same is true with anything. The same is true with your house. This is our forever house. We're never, ever going to leave this place. And then all of a sudden, you're driving down the road, and you see a flag, house for sale, right? Parade of homes. You're like, our house sucks. It's just the nature of appetites, right? Same thing is true with sex. No one has ever had sex and been like, I don't ever need to do that again. I'm good. Right? It's an appetite. It's true with achievement and progress. My first job was when I was 13 years old. I got a job corn detasseling, pulling tops off the corn stalks. And then when I was 14, I got a job as a janitor. And when I was 16, I got a job working at a hospital. And so, you know, then I want to keep moving up in the world, right? So I become a pastor. Yeah. So the same thing is true of acceptance. Think about this. We have an appetite for acceptance. And so I thought maybe this would end after middle school. But then you get to high school and you realize I still have this craving to be accepted. Maybe that'll end. Once I become an adult, that'll end, I'm sure, right? And now here I am, and I'm in my upper mid-30s, and still have a craving to be accepted. There's still an insecurity of like, I hope I can fit in. What is that? Same thing is true of success. Whenever you win something or accomplish something, we never think, I don't ever have to win again. I don't care if I ever accomplish anything else after this. There is something in us that wants to keep winning and keep succeeding and keep achieving and keep accomplishing and keep moving forward. And that is an appetite. And that appetite is never fully satisfied. And we can manage it, but it's never satisfied. By nature of what an appetite is, it always whispers more. There is something in us that when it comes to appetites, always wants more. And that's not bad in and of itself. In many ways, our appetites are a reflection of God in us. Progress is a good thing. Being productive is a good thing. Taking on responsibility is a good thing. And so God creates appetites, but here's the reality. If they're not managed, if they're not controlled, they can become very destructive. And all of us understand that. When we talk about it in these terms, all of us would acknowledge that, all of us would agree with that. And yet here's what we know from our own life experience, is that as much as we know that intellectually, emotionally, it's very, very difficult for us to control and for us to manage our own appetites. And here's why. Number four, appetites always whisper now, never later. Appetites always whisper now, never later. Appetites always focus our minds on what is right in front of us, on what is right here in the moment. And for some reason, everything else becomes blurred. Everything else kind of fades into the backdrop as we become emotionally attached to the moment. And here's why this is such an important topic for us this morning and today. The response that you and I have to our appetites and the response that we have to, you know, how we manage our appetites has a big impact on our quality of life and has a big impact on our life on this planet, has an impact on our relationships, has an impact on the way that we live, has an impact on the decisions that we make. So I want to spend the rest of our time together this morning looking at a story from a couple of brothers who lived about 4,000 years ago to illustrate this point. And I'll let you know right up front that this is not a feel-good story. Okay, so there are no bunnies or smiley faces or cotton candy or unicorns. The reason we're going to look at this is because it holds a very valuable lesson for each of us as it relates to this topic of our appetites. The story that we're looking at involves an entire family, but it really focuses specifically on two brothers named Jacob and Esau. Now, here's what we know about them. The author of Genesis is writing about this family and writes this in chapter 25. Says, as the boys grew up, these are twin brothers. Esau is older, born first. Jacob is the younger. As the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter. He was an outdoorsman. But Jacob had a quiet temperament, preferring to stay at home. Isaac, now Isaac is the dad. It says Isaac loved Esau, because he enjoyed eating the wild game Esau brought home. But Rebecca's the mom, Rebecca loved Jacob. So you can see right off the bat, they have a super healthy family dynamic. These two brothers, twin brothers, separated by a few minutes from each other, and yet we discover that they are very, very different from each other. Jacob is the younger one. Jacob is a mama's boy, right? He doesn't like to get his hands dirty. He likes to stay at home and clean the house and watch the view and sing Justin Bieber tunes. And, you know, he drives a Prius. He shops at Express for Men. That's Jacob, right? He's a very clean-shaven guy, the kind of guy you'd expect to see in a Calvin Klein ad. You know, he looks like he's 13 until he's 50. And then he describes Esau, and he's very different. Esau's the exact opposite. He drives an F-350, and he listens to Metallica, right? He wears snakeskin boots, and he watches Ultimate Fighting Championships, you know? And when he was a teenager, puberty hit him with a vengeance, right? It says he's a very hairy man, like Chewbacca, like he's the son of a Wookiee, basically. And so very extreme opposites. In fact, the verses we read said he hunted wild game. So he enjoys the hunt, and then he enjoys eating the stuff he slaughtered. That's Esau. And so here you have these vastly different guys. And here's how the story unfolds. Next verse. One day, when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau arrived home from the wilderness, exhausted and hungry. And so just so you get the picture, right? Jacob's home. He's in his tent. He's baking stuff with his Kiss the Cook apron on, probably whistling some Katy Perry. And Esau comes home from hunting all day, and he is hangry. He is like, I'm starving, right? Here's what happens. Esau said to Jacob, I'm starved. Now, we know this exaggerated, I'm starved thing. If you are a parent, you've heard that before from your kids. And you never are concerned for their safety. Like, I think they're actually starving. It's like an exaggeration. I'm starving. And you're like, you ate lunch 20 minutes ago. But our kid, no, I'm starving. What can I get you? You want this? You want this? No, I'm starving. I need ice cream. That's what you're starving for. And so this is kind of an exaggeration, right? Esau said to Jacob, I'm starved. Give me some of that red stew. All right, Jacob replied, but trade me your rights as the firstborn son. Ah, this is where the story gets very, very interesting. Jacob finds himself in a unique situation. He's in the position of power over his older brother. Now, those of you with an older sibling, you know this doesn't happen very often. Right? Because what usually happens is when you're growing up, they have all the power over you most of the time. Because they have the car first. They have the job. They have more money. They're stronger than you. They're bigger than you, more educated than you. And as you grow up, they have leverage over you. And so anytime that you are the younger one and a scenario like this unfolds where you unwittingly find yourself in possession of something that your older sibling wants, you're like, oh, okay, I'm in a position of power here. I see this play out with my two boys all the time at home. I have a 10-year-old and a 4-year-old. And my 4-year-old, anytime he wants to play a video game, my 10-year-old lords it over him. He's like, that's my video game. He's like, can I please play this? And he's like, well, what do you say? And he makes him go through this ritual of quoting certain phrases in just the right way. And then he's like, when you're done playing, what do you say? And he's like, I say, thank you, Layton, for letting me play the video game. He's like, that's right. And when I say it is your time to be done, what do you say? And he's like, then I'll be done. That's right. And he goes through this ritual with him. It's like, dude, you're just lording it over him just because you can. And it worked for a while, and that's recently starting to come to create some tension where my younger one's like, no, I'm not going to say that anymore. He's like starting to realize, but there's leverage there, right? He's like, I want to play the game, so I'll say these stupid phrases. And apparently, not much has changed between siblings in 4,000 years. Here's Jacob. He finds himself in a position of power, and he decides, I'm going to start doing some negotiating for myself. And so Jacob realizes that he has something that Esau wants. I'm starving. Give me that stew. Can I have a bowl of that stew? Oh, absolutely, I'll give you the bowl of the stew. Just trade me your rights as the firstborn son. That's all. Now, for us, that's difficult to wrap our minds around, okay, because we don't have this birthright in our culture. But if you know anything about birthrights, you'd be thinking, okay, Jacob has to be joking. There is no way Esau is going to give up his rights as the firstborn son for a bowl of stew. Think about it the way the monarchy works in the United Kingdom, right? Prince William is in line to become the next king. And he's only in line to become the next king because he was born first. It's nothing that he did to deserve it or earn it. He's just the firstborn. Prince Harry is not in line to be the king. Prince William's firstborn will then become the next in line. And so Prince Harry, doesn't matter what he does, he just wasn't born first. Now, we don't really have anything like this in our culture, but essentially in the ancient Near East civilizations, the way that this worked was the oldest son was given the birthright by the father, passed down from father to firstborn son. And it came with essentially three things. Finances. The firstborn son would get basically about three times the inheritance as any other kid. And so you have financial security. Not because they deserve it, just because you're the firstborn. Secondly, they would get influence. The firstborn, the child with the birthright, would become the judge in all family disputes. And so when there was tension or disputes in the family, you'd go to the firstborn son, and they would settle the matter. And their word was what you would abide by. And then thirdly, blessing. The birthright was associated with God's blessing on your life. And so the father would pray a blessing over the firstborn son and say, because God has blessed me and my life, I'm now passing on God's blessing to you. And now God will go with you and bless your life. And this is what Jacob is asking Esau to give up for a bowl of stew. This is a really big deal. Your future, your financial standing, your influence in the family, it's all attached to the birthright. And Jacob says to Esau, if you want this bowl of stew, just trade me your birthright. Now, this is crazy, right? That's like seeing a mansion for millions of dollars, and you go, hey, let's write them an offer for like $100. Let's just see if they take it. You know, let's just shot in the dark. Let's see what happens. And it's a crazy proposition. But let's check out Esau's response. Look, I'm dying of starvation, said Esau. What good is my birthright to me now? What good is my birthright? I won't last another minute. I need that stew. And all of you who are dudes can appreciate this because you were once a teenage boy, right? Teenage boys have two settings, sleeping and eating. And when they're not sleeping, they're eating, and they'll eat anything. They're like a goat. Right? They'll just eat a tin can if they're hungry enough. And the fact that Esau is hungry in this story makes total sense. But honestly, starving to death, like when you can walk into the house and declare that you're starving to death, you ain't starving to death. That's just the reality. But that's how he felt in the moment. And here's why. That's the power of appetite. That's the power of appetite. Appetite always whispers now and never later. Appetite says, think about the moment. Don't worry about how it'll affect your future. Appetite says, get satisfied now. Don't worry about how it'll affect the outcome of your life. You've got to deal with the moment. This is what matters. Appetites always whisper now, never later. And we look at Esau, and he's willing to give up all of his rights as the firstborn son. And we think, are you kidding? Are you being serious? Are you really about to make this trade? A bowl of stew for all of your rights as the firstborn son. Why would you do that? What are you thinking? And the answer is, he's thinking now, and he's not thinking about later. So Jacob says, first, you must swear that your birthright is mine. So Esau swore an oath. Esau, who is so hungry and so starving that a birthright isn't even going to do him any good because he's going to be dead within seconds, has time to pause and swear an oath, thereby selling all his rights as the firstborn to his brother Jacob. This doesn't even seem real, does it? Who does that? Who does that? There is no way he could possibly have realized all that he was giving up. Like if we could somehow jump into Bill and Ted's time machine and travel back 4,000 years and just jump into this story, we would tap Esau on the shoulder. And here's what we would say. Dude, be very careful. Do you understand the trade that you're making? There is a lot more at stake here than you can even comprehend. And I know you're hungry. I know it feels like you're starving. And don't give up your birthright, because let me tell you what's going to happen. Okay, I've had the benefit of reading stories about your family from 4,000 years in the future. And let me tell you exactly what's going to happen. Someone in your family is going to have a bunch of sons. And each of those sons is going to have families of their own, large families. And your family and their families will have a bunch of descendants. And eventually, it's going to become a nation. And hundreds of years from now, God is going to reveal himself to one of your descendants. And the way that he's going to reveal himself is by saying this: I am the God of your father, Abraham, and I'm the God of your father, Isaac, and I'm the God of your father. And then he's going to say, Esau. And he's going to say your name. And if you take that bowl of stew, all of that changes. All of that goes away. You're not the firstborn. You don't have the rights of the firstborn. You won't be, that won't be your legacy anymore. Matter of fact, Esau, 2,000 years from now, God is going to do something absolutely incredible. He's going to come into our world, and he's going to reveal himself in flesh and blood, in human form. And one of Jesus' disciples, a guy named Matthew, he's gonna write about the life and teachings of Jesus. And when he starts writing about Jesus' life, when he starts writing about Jesus, who is God in human form, and he writes about his life, the way that he's gonna start his account is by writing about the family line of Jesus. He's gonna start with a genealogy and a family history of the lineage of Jesus. And here's what he's gonna write. He's gonna write that Abraham was the father of Isaac, and that Isaac was the father of Esau. I thought there were fireworks going off outside. I didn't know what that was. He's going to say, and Abraham is the father of Isaac, and Isaac is the father of Esau. And he's going to say your name. And then through your family line, Jesus is going to come into the world and show us who God is. That's going to be your legacy, but if you take this bowl of stew, it all goes away. And unfortunately, nobody was there to provide context for Esau. And no one was there to help him understand the consequence of that decision, because appetites always whisper now and never later. And we can only see what's in front of us at the moment. We can only see what is going on right here in this moment. How do we satisfy this appetite? Everything else becomes blurred. Everything else fades into the backdrop. But here's what ends up happening in Genesis 25. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and lentil stew, and Esau ate the meal and got up and left. He showed contempt for his rights as the firstborn. Isn't that crazy? This wasn't a lifetime supply of stew. This wasn't, I'll drive the camel over with stew to your tent once a week for the rest of your life. This is one bowl of stew. Who would do that? Who would make that kind of a trade? Who would forfeit future success and future finances and future respect for a bowl of stew? I'll tell you who. You would. And I would. If it was the right bowl of stew. That's the truth, because all of us have the exact same inclination to give in to our appetites as Esau did. Which is why someone would risk a family that they've had for 15 years for a relationship with a coworker that lasts 2 months. Because appetites whisper now and never later. It's why someone with adequate income will shipwreck their financial security buying more and more and more stuff, because appetites always whisper now, never later. And every single one of us has the propensity to give up something as big as a birthright for something in the moment, because appetites always whisper now, never later. And the reason that we find it so difficult to manage our appetites, even though we know this, even though we would agree with this. None of us would say, oh, I totally disagree with that. We go, yeah, that makes sense. Intellectually, we recognize that. We understand that. We agree with that. But the reason we find it so difficult to actually manage our appetites is because we really believe on some level that what's in front of us in the moment is going to bring happiness. It's going to bring satisfaction. And our brains lie to us and tell us it's going to last longer and feel better than it actually will. we are terrible predictors of our own emotional future. We tell ourselves, this night, this website, this car, this job, this house, this relationship, it's going to ultimately satisfy. And the reality is we know that it can't bring ultimate satisfaction because it's an appetite. It's never going to be fully satisfied. We're always going to want more. We are absolutely horrible at predicting how strongly we will feel about something or predicting how long that feeling will actually last. That's why we give into our appetites. That's why we head down wrong paths that we know we shouldn't, and we convince ourselves to go down those paths, is because we are ultimately emotionally attached to something in the moment. And when that happens, we lose sight of the later. We focus on now, and what's later fades away. It gets blurred into the backdrop. You have no idea what's at stake when you fail to manage your appetites. You have no idea what God wants to do through you or through your kids or through your grandkids. You have no idea what hangs in the balance of your decision to manage your appetites and to choose later over now. So I want to challenge you with this. Don't risk your family. Don't risk your financial future. Don't risk your reputation. Don't risk your influence. Don't risk your relationship with your kids. Don't risk your marriage. Don't risk your career. Don't risk your legacy on something right now. That promises, oh no, this will make you happy. It's all about now. Don't worry about later. Just focus on the moment. Get satisfied. Because I promise you, appetites always whisper now and never later. And it always costs you later. See, here's Esau's legacy. In Exodus chapter 3, it says this: God said to Moses, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Not the God of Esau, the God of Jacob. Not even the firstborn. I am your father. I'm your God, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Later on, Matthew is writing the family history and the lineage of Jesus. And he says, Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was the father of Jacob. And Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers. Jacob's name eventually gets changed to Israel, and Israel becomes a nation. And that's really the last that we hear of Esau until the author of Hebrews brings up Esau one more time. In Hebrews 12, it says, make sure that no one is immoral or godless like Esau, who traded his birthright as the firstborn son for a single meal. In other words, this is borderline immoral or godless to give up something that you want in your future for something that can only satisfy you in the moment. Appetites are so powerful. We carry them around with us every day, but we've got to learn to manage them because there is a lot at stake. I could give you the names of hundreds of people who lost their marriage, lost their relationship with their kids, lost their influence, lost a career, lost their reputation over an appetite that they simply could never learn how to manage. Every single day, you and I will be offered a bowl of stew. That promises to satisfy. That promises to make us happy in the moment. And some days it will be easier to resist, and some days it will be more difficult. And so here's what we've got to learn. To manage my appetites, I must reframe them. To manage my appetites, I must reframe them. In other words, I've got to pull out of saying it's just about this moment, and I've got to look at the context. I've got to provide context for myself, because nobody's coming along and tapping us on the shoulder from 4,000 years in the future and saying, look, I've heard about your family, and if you'll just do this, then it's going to work out for you. And so we've got to create context for ourselves. And so here's the question we've got to ask ourselves. Where do I want to be, and who do I want to be 1 year from now, and 5 years from now, and 10 years from now? Who do I want to be? What do I want my marriage to look like a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? What do I want my relationship with my kids to look like a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? What do I want my career to look like a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? What do I want my health to look like? What do I want my relationship with God to look like? What is that picture? What is that preferred future? And does what is being offered to me in the moment have the potential to rob me of that preferred future? Does this thing that is being offered and promises me, oh, it's going to satisfy, does it have the potential to rob me of where I want to be and who I want to be and the marriage I want to have and the career I want to have and the relationship with my kids I want to have, the relationship with God I want to have? And we have to reframe our appetites. What's your bolus to? What is that thing that is being held out to you right now that is promising more than it can ever deliver? What is that thing that you're trying to talk yourself into? That you, deep in the sort of the recesses of your mind, you know that is not going to fully satisfy. That's your bolus too. So name that appetite. Reframe the appetite. Bring context to it. And begin to manage those things. Because ultimately, I can tell you this, folks. There is only one thing that brings satisfaction. See, you and I were created by God and for God. We were created to exist in loving, trusting relationship with God and with each other. That's the only thing that satisfies, is to say, okay, God, I have all these desires for all these things, but at the end of the day, I'm putting my trust in you that you're going to help fully satisfy the desires of my heart in your way and in your timing. And I can rest and live fully in the trust that your timing and your way works best, because I was created by you, and you know me so well, and you delight in fulfilling the desires of my heart. And so until we acknowledge that, then life is going to be one continual pursuit after another that ultimately leaves us unsatisfied and wanting more. But Jesus wants to give us life, and he wants to give us life to the absolute fullest. And he came to earth to show us what that looks like. And in his incredible love for us, scriptures tell us that he was put to death, his body was laid in a tomb, and according to multiple eyewitness accounts, he rose from the dead. What that means is death is not the end, and you and I have been invited to be a part of God's family. And as a part of God's family, that means we put our trust in him and say, okay, God, I have these desires, but I'm trusting you with them, that you will help me to live life in such a way that those desires are satisfied through you, in your way and in your timing. And if you're here today and you say, man, you know, I've never looked at it that way, and I've never made the decision to fully put my trust in Jesus and say yes. I love the song that we sang today, The Reckless Love of God. I couldn't earn it. There's nothing I've done to deserve it. But still, you give yourself away. That's what God does for us, and he invites us into his family, and there's nothing you can do to earn it or deserve it. But if you've never said yes to this invitation to be a part of God's family, to have your heart and your life fully satisfied by Jesus, then I want to invite you to say yes to that invitation. And it's not something that you can earn or not anything we deserve. It's an invitation that's been extended to each and every one of us. And if you'd like to say yes to that, you can do it right where you sit through this very simple prayer. It goes like this. Jesus, please forgive my sins. Forgive me for those times I've walked away from you. Thank you that you've never walked away from me. And God, I pray that you would help heal the brokenness to my life. Sometimes brokenness between myself and you, or sometimes brokenness between myself and others. And help me to put my trust in your way of living life, your timing, your way of doing things. Satisfy the desires of my heart. Adopt me into your family. Make me your son. Make me your daughter. And help me to follow your way of living life as best as I know how from this moment on. In Jesus' name, amen.